I would like to call to order the regular supplemental meetings, and Josh will have me do 20 push-ups as punishment later,
and recess
the 10 for each meeting, and then reset the supplemental meeting.
Thank
you. I apologize for that. Jill did make it in the right font for me to see it, so it's her fault. So we've done that. Welcome to the trustees. We've had our moment of silence, and now we're looking at the meeting minutes. Any questions or comments on those? Do we have a motion to approve those?
I move we approve it.
Second?
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries. The detailed consent agenda. Anything, Kelly, you want to flag for us?
There's one item, and you'll see it occasionally. It's on page 16. We won't pull it up here because this information is confidential, but in your package you'll see. There's an item, number 8, called Spouse Wed After Retirement. We refer to that as a SWAR, and I just want to let the newer trustees know what that is.
I think it's 6 on the...
Oh, 6, you're right. My font is small. So what that is when a member retires from the system, if they're married at the time, any spouse gets an automatic, we call it basically a free 50% survivor benefit. But if you're not married or you are married and get divorced and you subsequently get remarried, you have an opportunity to purchase that by reducing your benefits. So that's what that is, if you're wondering in the future what those are.
So that's somebody after they retire, they remarry, and then they reduce
that. Right. So, and we also have CARS. So we have SWARs for spouses and CARS, and CAR stands for Child Acquired After Retirement. Those are less common.
Okay.
Kelly, I have a question on number 3, refund of combined pension plan. It looks like we had a lot leave in December. Was any inside information as to why so many left? I mean, on both sides, usually you see more police than you do fire, but it looks equal.
I think it has to do with the timing of the rookie classes, because a lot of times when we have rookie classes, there's a pretty large number that don't make it through. And I know they had both rookie classes for police and fire, so that may be some of it. But
okay.
Other than that, I don't know.
Okay. We have a motion to approve the consent agenda.
Move.
Second. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries. Anyone from the public would like to say anything? John, anyone online that wants to?
If they're on the conference call, press 5-star on the phone. I'll raise your hand.
Okay. All right, so moving on, we'll go to item D1. Steve, would you like to give a report on the professional service provider meeting?
Sure. Tony, Mark, and Marcus and I met with Chuck Campbell this morning. Chuck is with Jackson Walker and represents us as trustees for the pension. It's a great working relationship that he has directly with Kelly and Josh. Very fluid. They don't always agree, which is probably a good thing, but they certainly take his advice and making sure the plan is administered the way it needs to be done. So it's all really positive feedback of what we're doing with Chuck and Jackson Walker. We wanted to again thank Chuck for his work and what he does for us as trustees and what he does for the men and women of the police and fire department.
Anything else? Okay. Anyone else on the committee have any thoughts or comments? Okay. All right. Kelly, the monthly contribution report.
This is the on page 16 is your monthly contribution report. It's no different than the prior months. This is the November data. There were 2 pay periods in November. You'll see on page 19, the contributions were short the floor by $311,288 for the month of November. So we received that in addition to the floor. We have December to come, which will also have the same floor, and then once we hit into January, the floor actually reduces, so you won't see additional contributions, I think, probably in any month going forward. So in a sense, the floor is meaningless after January, but we'll keep reporting how the contributions what the trend is of the contributions, because that's important as we move forward, as you well know. Are there any questions about the contribution report?
And this year, we still have a big shortfall on employees, pretty much close to 200 every month.
We do.
They're not making a dent on that?
They're not making it much of a dent, but I know they're trying. It seems they're trying, and I know, as we've seen, they've given pretty sizable raises over the last, well, since the bills passed, really, which is great. Otherwise, the shortfall would be much, much greater than it is.
Education and travel?
On page 24, you'll see the upcoming classes. Ken Haven is asked to attend the TechSPRS annual conference. When we put this together, we didn't have an estimate in here, but it's approximately $1,000. This class is actually, it's the annual TechSPRS conference. It's a very good conference down in Austin for about $1,000. So if the board agrees to allow Ken to attend that, I would need a motion for that.
What do we have? We have a limit per trustee per year or something like that. What is that?
We do. Brenda, do you know?
Let me.
We budget so much for each trustee.
Right, we do, and we typically base that, I think, on attending NCPRS and or TechSPRS. And then every trustee during their term can do a special training, such as Wharton's used to have an investment class, those types of things.
Bear with me a minute while I get that pulled up.
Melissa, will you ask Carol, she might know the number off the top of her head, what the individual trustee annual amounts are?
I think it was $5,000.
Okay.
So in total, we budgeted $34,000 mm-hmm. for all trustees, with just a limit for any single trustee not to exceed $5,000.
Yeah, $5,000.
Okay.
Okay.
Good. That's good.
All right.
You need a motion to approve?
Yes, please.
I'll move that.
Second?
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries. Before we turn it over to Ryan, Melissa, I would like to thank you for your excellent, just well put together report. At some point, we're going to have a poll over who has the most dated picture. and let's hope that the state legislature doesn't pass some law on how old these pictures can be. I have my own sense of who's here is the most dated, but. It's obviously an ex-trustee, so it's not any of you guys, but I was getting kind of a kick out of that. So. All right, Ryan, portfolio update.
All right, thank you, Nick. So I'm on 28, diligent here. So as always, liquidation of the private market portfolio is the top focus. We ended the year with $109 million in private market proceeds, $8.5 million coming back in December. We're doing the quarterly review of private market proceeds and projections later today, so we'll cover that in more detail. Of that 109, 40 of it has been redeployed into the public equity portfolio since June, and then the remaining amounts went to pay benefit outflows or refill the safe reserve in the first half of the year. As a reminder, at the March board meeting, the board put the safe reserve into drawdown mode to fund benefit outflows. On rebalancing, we funded the Dashmore mandate at the end of September, or we liquidated Ashmore and funded the new MetLife EM debt mandate in September, and then we redeployed $26 million into small cap equity in mid-November. And then with the $8.5 million come back in December, we have another potential rebalancing that we could look at probably in the next few weeks. So we'll get back to IAC and you guys on what the plan there would be. So estimated year-to-date return, which is the 2022 return, is down 2.9% for the overall portfolio and down 15.1% for the public markets portion. So we'll give a bit more detail on kind of how we get those two numbers in a minute here. So a few macro slides, looking at the equity market drawdown, looks similar to what it has the past few months, but a few things. EM has caught up quite a bit over the last 2 months of the year, and then we're seeing some divergence there between EFA, which is International Domestic U.S., and U.S. So I think this is only the second year in the last five or six that international has outperformed U.S. So this chart is showing that S&P 500 intra-year declines on average, and then where we ended up the year. The deepest drawdown was 25%. We ended the year down 19% on the S&P, and then the same type of information on, and this is the third worst year in the last, since 1980 for the S&P 500. And looking at the bond market, obviously, given the increase in rates, this is the worst year ever for U.S. bonds, at least the worst year since 1976. So when we combine those two points of information, if you look at the 60-40 portfolio, it's the third worst year ever. The only two other ones were Great Depression and 1930. So on to some better news and what the go-forward outlook looks like from there.
Well, even on that one, just we should point out, I mean, we were down 15-1 in our public markets mm-hmm. versus 16-9, so we outperformed
yeah.
the 60-40 benchmark.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Bill. So looking forward, the chart on the left shows what the return would be on the S&P 500 to get back to the previous market peak. So go-forward returns in equity, you know, in this level of drawdown typically look pretty good, so we'd be looking, you know, kind of depending on how long it takes, you know, potentially double-digit returns going forward. And then we actually are getting some yield in the fixed income portfolio now. So our core bond portfolio is yielding over 5 right now. So moving on to our portfolio, we ended the year at $1.825 billion in AUM. Started the year at $1,991. We had $109 million in benefit outflows, so that averages out to $9.1 million a month, which is a little bit less than what we're projecting when we do the safety reserve go-forward projection, which is 9.5. And as a reminder, this 2.9% return we're talking about here is lagged, which means it's on a quarter lag. It includes the Q4 2021 write-ups that occurred in the private equity portfolio, so there's some pretty significant increases that occurred at end of last year that are rolling into this number here. So on the public market portfolio, I'll start at the right side of the page on the three-year return. The 60-40, you know, our public portion of the portfolio is up 2.3% compared to a 60-40, which is up 0.5% over the three-year return. Three of our four active global managers have outperformed on a three-year rolling or three-year trailing return, so that's what we'd like to see. We added anything that's in the gray text here is we're using composite returns. It was a little bit unclear last month what was our actual return when we were invested with the fund compared to the fund or the strategy's performance. So anything is, hopefully you can see it well enough here, shading in gray is our return while we've been invested and then using the composite back to the three-year. So looking at the 2022 return, down 15.1 compared to the 60-40 we're looking at here, which is global ag and global international ACWI stock, is down 17.5. On our four active global managers, what we're seeing here is kind of what we would expect to see in a market like this, where our value managers with Boston Partners and Manulife have outperformed more than our growth managers have underperformed with Invesco and Walter Scott. Looking at RBC, the EM equity manager, they've held up relatively to the benchmark quite well, outperforming by 5.9% in 2022. And then we've talked about the fixed income portfolio, down 10 or 9.7 for the year compared to down 19 for the benchmark. And a lot of that is the shorter duration and the U.S. bias that we have in the fixed income portfolio.
So this shows we outperformed 60-40 for 3 years as well, according to this, right?
Yeah.
Do we know what the five-year number would be, or do you have that somewhere?
We don't run it that far back. We can get it from Makita probably in a couple weeks.
Yeah, I think at some point. It's just maybe next month just for
yeah.
that. Because I think that's a good, you know, period. 3 to 5 years is what most people look at.
Yeah. And, I mean, if you look down at kind of where the 3 years coming from, a lot of that is still the fixed income and the duration of our portfolio and it being U.S. based, yeah, largely. So this is kind of the breakdown of how we got to that 2.9% return for the overall portfolio between the contribution of the public market portfolio, which is the blue bar on the negative side, and then the pinkish bar at 7.5 up for the private markets portfolio. So the little over two-thirds that were in public markets returned 15.1% negative, and then the 30-ish percent on average that were in private markets returned 25%. So that's bringing that number all the way up to the negative 2.9. So. All right, on the safety reserve, we ended the year at $125 million in the cash and short-term bonds compared to a target of $164 million, with maybe a little bit of buffer in there at the $9.5 million per month projected. That would be enough money in that portfolio to cover benefit outflows through end of this year and into January of 24. On cash, we're at 71.1 right now. We should be good on cash through at least Q1. We'll look at potential rebalancing actions or pulling more money over from IRM at the kind of as we get into Q2. This is just a detailed asset allocation. We've been putting money into small cap equity as we had proceeds coming back the last few months. I think where we might look next is, and that this column here in the middle, we're showing kind of percentage of target. Sorry, John, I hit the wrong one there. Trying to use our Zoom feature on a remote here. There we go. So that's just showing percentage of target. Where we would probably go next is looking at adding to the passive Northern Trust mandate and then continue to fill up passive and small cap as we get closer to pro rata to target. Scheduled planned investment reviews. So we kind of kick that off with Clarion potentially and real estate and work through the real assets portfolio through Q1 and Q2. So any questions on the portfolio update before we move forward?
I'll just make the comment that, you know, I think that $109 million of cash distributions out of our legacy illiquid private assets is a really significant accomplishment. You don't ultimately control any of that, but I think we've done over multiple years a lot of really smart things, the staff has, to facilitate the chances that that would occur. And, you know, we just think about, with a down market year, the safety reserve had none of that or significantly less of that happened. We might feel a little bit more, you know, tight about all sorts of things. So I think that's a real, real accomplishment. I think you're going to talk about this more. You know, the private market return for the year, you know, it is what it is, but, you know, there's the Huff write-up, you know, in that number. You know, ultimately, private markets, unless you have an asset class that is completely uncorrelated to the stock market overall, and there are a few like that. I mean, you can be in timber or certain sort of, you know, oil and gas type things. There are some things that are not that correlated, but everything else is correlated to the stock market. It's just that you don't always get the real-time pricing that reflects that. And there's a whole thing about lots of pension funds going into private assets, and there's some phrase like liquidity or volatility hiding or evasion or something like that, because the mark-to-markets aren't in the stock market every day. They're what third-party valuation people say it are, which is, you know, open to more manipulation and, you know, subjectivity and things like that. So I really, really like the fact that we produced that liquidity. Going forward, once again, positioned ourselves well to produce more liquidity, although we ultimately don't control any of that liquidity, you know, whether it occurs or not. The public market, I tend to look at it more, you know, I think Michael said, or Bill, what's the rolling 3 or 5 years? You know, I look at it more that way, and the three-year number, you know, looks pretty good. And then 2022 was just really an aberration because both the bond market and the stock market, you know, went down. You know, the bond market was sort of a catch-up for you know, 20 or 30 years of declining interest rates, just kind of a reset. So that's the way I kind of, you know, look at it.
Appreciate it, Nick. And yeah, I think we're fortunate to have the proceeds coming back, because I think a lot of peer plans that have, you know, less mature private equity portfolios are putting a lot of money, having to put money to work in form of capital calls as opposed to having money come back to them. So, all right, moving forward, report on the Investment Advisory Committee meeting of December 15th. I'll kind of cover the high levels, and then, Bill, if you have anything you want to add,
sure,
we can go from there. Just to inform you guys, Scott Freeman, who was one of the original outside IAC members, he got to the end of his term, and we appreciate his service, but he's not staying on the committee. So, what? He was one of the original. I think he was renewed, but he started in 18.
Okay.
And then we renewed it through the end of this year. We'll need to reappoint a few terms next month, and then we need to have a majority of outside people in the IAC. So right now we have 4 board members and 4 outside members of the committee. It looks like we've identified a potential outside member that could be a fit. So we have some conversations there.
Okay, I wasn't aware of that.
Yeah, there needs to be a majority outside.
No, I said I didn't know we had identified somebody, because I think that was one of the things. I think if anybody on the board knows of somebody who would be a good quality person, we should bring that forward.
Yeah, how was that person identified?
Nick, no.
Yeah, I just sent it. Call it incredibly preliminary.
Yeah.
So it's not, I mean, obviously people on the committee need to weigh in. It's just a name, someone who I think would be qualified.
Yeah, and like,
so they'd be interested.
Yeah.
I feel like we're always looking for outside people, so if anyone else knows anyone that could be a fit or
I think
interested.
What Brian
they
said
have
was a premature version of,
okay,
we have a name for you guys to consider to begin the process to look at.
I just think we should try to get as big a universe as we can of people. So and it would be
if
nice to have some
back
to
the, group. Yeah,
and put it in the portal. All right. So
that said, you look, I mean, I hate to belabor the point, but are you looking for someone that is specifically an expert in a particular area?
I didn't, I mean,
a generalist.
Overall
investment,
he was like, you know, expertise.
I think, I think ideally you'd like more of a generalist. I mean, we've got a couple of good ones now, where Rakesh, who does SMU's endowment. We've got Tom Tull, who did the ERS. So, I mean, somebody who's been through asset allocation and multiple asset classes, RFPs, things of that. The broader the experience, the better.
Yeah. And, I mean, this will change when we start doing new private markets, but the IAC has been more focused on assisting with public manager searches the last couple of years as opposed to dealing with our legacy private portfolio.
That's right.
So we have 2 CIOs, current CIOs, and 2 former CIOs as part of the outside members of the IAC right now. So.
That's good.
Invesco, the growth equity global manager, came in and did a portfolio review. They've underperformed in 2022 and kind of bleeding into longer-term performance. So we're digging deeper into their portfolio, having some discussions with Makita. We expect to come back to the committee in March with a recommendation on how to move forward there.
Yeah, I mean, I think they underwhelmed the committee, I think, in their presentation, and they tend to be a much more concentrated, volatile portfolio, which – and my view is that's probably not what we need here. We want something more down the fairway that's not going to be way out of the whack. So we're looking to see, you know, just understand it better in March.
Mm-hmm.
Ryan's going to let us know what he thinks.
Yeah, and I think what we need to think about there is also kind of how they, whatever we do with that growth equity mandate, how that fits with what else we have in the portfolio on the 3 other managers on the global side.
Is there any growth equity that's not volatile right now?
Yeah, I mean,
less volatile.
It's all relative, right?
They have a top-heavy and pretty concentrated portfolio. I think a lot of the potential names we would look at would also be volatile, but I think there's some portfolio construction things that we need to get comfortable or not with Invesco specifically. So 2 items that we're going to talk about coming up shortly that we talked about with IAC is the diverse and emerging manager item, and then the consultant RFP subcommittee and process going forward there. So I'll cover that in more detail in a second here. But
just to answer Tina's question, our other growth manager was down 19% last year versus the index of 18, but these guys are down 31.
Oh, okay.
So the difference in volatility.
Yeah, there is not.
Yeah. And I mean, that's always been the case with Invesco, but it's just we got to, you know, kind of take a deeper look there, figure out what to do going forward. All right, so I'll do a summary on the private asset cash flows. Given it's the end of the year, beginning of next year, we'll cover in a bit more detail than normal what came back compared to what we had targeted last year. Nick kind of covered it well, but we don't have a lot of control over when stuff comes back. We're building up projections on this portfolio on an asset-by-asset basis. There's a schedule in the closed session materials that shows, you know, kind of asset-by-asset, if it's legacy, if it's not, when we expect to come back, and then you know, a separate presentation on kind of a little bit more information on each investment and why we're projecting that. I say that the further along we go in this process, it's the assets that haven't sold, we probably have even less control over. So it's, you know, I think big picture going forward, and we'll show this on a few of the charts, it's going to be lumpier and a little bit less predictable what's coming back as the portfolio gets smaller and smaller. The $109 million that we got back this year was 20% of the portfolio value at the beginning of the year, so we were able to kind of, you know, return a fifth of the portfolio during the year. So this is looking at kind of going all the way back to when we started liquidating private markets assets in September of 16. We had $1.55 billion in the portfolio. We've had $1.3 billion in distributions over that time period, which is 7 years now. $250 million in capital calls back into the portfolio, and then an increase in market value of $133 to get to our current end-of-year private market value of $591 million. And that compares to $538 million at the end of last year. So even though we had $109 million come back, we had those significant write-ups in the private equity that is keeping the value actually higher than it was last year.
Where are we on the you had a plan every year that you were going to try to liquidate so much. Are you ahead of that on the legacy assets?
No, like if you went back and looked at this presentation from 2 years ago, mm-hmm. 3 years ago, we have not made as much progress as we thought we could have. I think some of that goes into, you know, this stuff just ended up taking longer. Nothing really occurred during COVID year. I think, you know, we had 109 this year, 155, I believe, last year, and then it was like we only had $38 million in 2020. So, and then, you know, our concentration of that 591 right now is really concentrated in three assets, Hop, Lone Star, AEW. We're comfortable in, you know, with AEW and when stuff's coming back, and they've produced the majority of proceeds the last 2.5 years, yeah. You know. Coming out of that portfolio, it's, and then Lone Star actually started to produce some distributions this year as well. The big, you know, factor is Huff when that occurs and what the value will be. So moving forward, in Q4 we had $55 million come back. So of the 109, over about half of it came back in Q4. A few large distributions that we had talked about from the AEW portfolio. The J.P. Morgan Maritime Fund, which is maybe one of our more uncorrelated this year on valuation assets, has started to produce. It'll get towards the end of the fund life there. We got $12.5 million back in Q4. I think they'll be one of the bigger drivers of proceeds coming back next year into the portfolio. We had the portfolio company sale, the Lone Star CRA Fund. If you guys remember way back to the Idaho property, that we sold, there was a seller note that was repaid early at the end of the year, so we got $2.5 million back from that. That was a bit of a surprise at year end. And then the Huff alternative, that's kind of residual proceeds that came back from a sale that occurred earlier this year. So looking at 2022 actual versus what we had targeted, skipped ahead there. So I guess starting at the bottom, because it's the biggest number, $57 million, so over half the proceeds came from real estate, and most of that came from the AEW portfolio. Moving up to private equity, we got $30 million-ish back from the private equity portfolio. So 30% of the total amount that came back came from private equity, and that $29 million from private equity is the most we've received out of that portfolio in the last 5 years. But really, like where we have not met targets it's been in the private equity portfolio. We still were a little bit below what we had expected this year, but it's definitely started producing, you know, some proceeds where it hadn't before. And then infrastructure, the $16 million there, that's all from the Maritime Fund. So the other two investments there are the two Asian infrastructure funds, and we have not seen proceeds come out of those funds yet, anything material. So when I talked about being a little bit less predictable and lumpy going forward, I said, we, you know, over half of what we got this year came in Q4. It was the third highest quarter in the last 5 years of proceeds. So I think it'll look more like it has the last couple of years than the earlier years where it was more of a constant stream of money coming in. So it, I think it just goes into, you know, using that knowledge or expectation to kind of manage where we're at on cash and what the safe reserve levels look like going forward. So I'll talk a little bit about what we're projecting for 2023 here. This is looking at kind of where we're at with the blue line and then what we expect to occur over the next 2 years with the dotted blue line there. So we're projecting $288 million to come back in 2023, which is a really large number, but as with everything else, HOP is the wild card. So if you look at kind of outside of HOP, what we're expecting to occur, it's $112 million, which is in line with what we've done the last 2 years, and I think quite achievable. So it's really, you know, I would say, you know, if HOP occurs, it's going to come back in one amount, and what that amount is, it's still TBD. But, you know, we're pretty confident in the rest of the projections as far as what's in progress and what it could look like.
What's the target for Lone Star for 23 in terms of
Josh.
They don't have one for 23 in terms of what they have to.
Didn't we have a target for a three-year target?
We can talk about it in legal.
Okay.
Brian, I do think it would be helpful for you at a future point to, if you go back to since September 30, to give us some sense of versus the values back then, what the gains and losses were. Like, you always can get, you know, liquidity by selling something at some bargain price, but we were faced with conflicting things of desiring liquidity but wanting to preserve value. And so, you know, it's something you have to manage through. So I think it'd be helpful to see maybe you stratify it by year, going starting at the book values or whatever were the values at the end of 2016 or whatever starting point you want, and show what the gains and losses were on the cumulative distributions.
Okay. Yeah, I'll think about kind of the best way to show that.
Do you all agree that'd be helpful information?
Yeah, definitely.
So you basically want to see at that, so for each asset that had a distribution?
Not just by year, like every, you know, you have a cumulative number by quarter, whatever. Did we, you know, generate liquidity 1 year by selling things at 30% off what the stated value was, or did we get, you know, what it was booked at or more or whatever? I think that'd be helpful to see as we kind of build the case for good stewardship since we have the legislation.
Yeah. And I mean, this kind of shows the private market return by year, but I think what you're talking about is on the stuff that we actually sold during that year that we realized.
Monetized.
A lot of this is kind of the big write-ups and write-downs that are in the stuff that we currently have as opposed to what was sold.
But that's a good point, from the original cost basis versus the write-down from the previous year.
Well, whatever was the stated value on the books when the legislation or, you know, the year end.
Just high level, the two big bars in the first two columns there was the secondary sale in the private equity portfolio, and we sold that at 87% of NAV. And then the other one is the toll road sale that we actually, I would have to double check, but we received quite a bit above NAV during that sale. So kind of figuring out the rest. So we'll do some more work on that and report back.
But the real estate would be an interesting one to see, too, because we've been getting distributions.
Yeah.
You know, how they've been versus the NAV.
Okay. This is just looking at, you know, based on those projections, the composition of the private markets portfolio that is considered legacy versus non-legacy, and what it looks like at the end of the next 2 years or expected to look like. And then this is...
When the legislation occurred, what would be the percent of total BPFP portfolio that's 21% now? What was that number?
In the 50s? I mean, private markets were two-thirds, and it was probably in the 40s, I would say, but I'll check that number, too.
Yeah.
This is looking at our private market allocation over time, so that's where, you know, kind of in the 16, 17, we were at two-thirds in private markets, down to 31% right now. That little mini spike you've seen this year is, you know, double effect of the private equity write-ups and then the decrease in the public markets portfolio. And then looking forward, I'd expect that, based on these projections, we would get below target in Q1 of next year. So kind of keep that in mind when we're thinking about when we start making new private markets investments going forward. So, any other questions we can talk about in here on the private markets?
Ryan, can you go back to 49?
49? Yeah.
So if you look at this, you can see that, you know, there's big differences in the private equity line, in the natural resources line, and what you'll see is as we go through this year, we're either going to make the number or we're going to be under by a lot or maybe over by a lot, and that's because the assets that we have left are big chunks. And like the natural resources here, that's because one sale we thought was going to happen didn't happen. So, you know, it's not unusual for one sale to fall through that we think is going to happen, and that's $25 million you expected. So those numbers Ryan said about what we expect next year, you know, it doesn't take a whole lot to be way under or way over those. And he has provided for you more detail on this schedule in the closed session so you can see exactly what happened with what we thought would happen with certain assets and what didn't happen, or what did happen, and then also detailed by assets going forward, what we expect. So just wanted to add that.
Thanks, Kelly. Any other questions, comments here? Okay. All right, moving forward. So this item, D7 here. So if you guys remember way back to the August board meeting, we had Makita come in and talk about their initiatives on public manager searches as far as their stats on hiring or their clients hiring diverse managers. As part of the discussion, it came up if DPFE should have a policy to ensure the inclusion of diverse or emerging managers, which we do not have right now. So the board directed staff to take a look at this and then to seek IAC input on it. We talked about it at the December 15th IAC meeting. Looking at kind of what some other Texas plans have in terms of policy, what Gilbert had shown another plan that he was on the board member of does on that front for diverse and emerging managers, and then what to do going forward. So what we have come up with, and I think the first we have kind of what the purpose and objective of this would be, and then what would actually qualify. So I think the last sentence here is probably the key one, and the purpose and objective is, you know, by adding this, we think that we can find managers, diverse or small managers, that can enhance the risk-adjusted return of DPFP. So, that's kind of one thing we need to consider and make sure that the board agrees with that, and we can put it into the policy if that's the case. So what this would actually do, moving on to the next page here, is on all public manager searches, staff would request an RFP from at least one emerging or diverse manager as long as the firm met the minimum criteria. So what qualifies would be a manager that has over 50% ownership from any combination of female, veteran, disabled, or minority ownership, or a manager that has less than $2 billion in total AUM and has not been around for or been founded no more than 10 years ago. So a newer, small firm.
Is that what you're defining emerging manager right now?
Yeah, so like that would be the emerging part of it, and
that's
then
$2 billion and not around for 10 years.
Yes.
Well,
so
it's going to be hard. I mean, depending on the mandate, if you had a public equity guy and give him $180 million.
Yeah, I mean, it would not work across. We looked at, you know, should that be a different threshold by search, and it gets a little bit complicated there. The $2 billion level, that's what is in the statute for ERS plan we had looked at, and what some of the other Texas plans use. I think one topic for discussion here should be, you know, this item really came up talking about diversity of ownership, and then a lot of people in their emerging programs also have a size component. But
so one point to your question, to your comment, Bill, the language specifically only relates to public searches, so it wouldn't relate.
Yeah,
to
no, I understand that.
Yeah.
But even a public search for a global equity manager allocation would pretty much disqualify somebody under $2 billion.
Yeah,
right.
Unless you're going to be 30% of their assets, which
yeah,
you don't
right.
want to be.
And I mean, like on the size, when we were looking at small cap, we viewed smaller sizes, you know, favorable in that area. But when we were looking at EM debt, to do that, you need to be, you know, larger. You know,
do we even need point two? And I mean, we can deal with
I think that's the discussion. I would say kind of the way this discussion has gone and evolved over the last few months and discussion with the IAC, I think it came up more talking about diversity of ownership, and this is something that other people look at as well. So I think it's more focused and more clear what we're trying to do if you keep it at point one.
I would think that would be a better way to do it.
And then I would say the last four searches that we've done, we have included a diverse firm in every one of the searches. So what we're proposing to add to the policy would just kind of codify what we've already done in the last four searches and make it a little bit more clear to staff on what the what needs to be done to make sure we're being inclusive going forward. So
I thought that, and this is where I'm looking at the word or,
mm-hmm.
I thought what our goal would be is that our desire would be in a search
mm-hmm.
to include a firm that meets the criteria of the minority ownership, but that would not be disqualified because its assets were
right.
below
yeah.
$2 billion.
To echo
so
Gilbert,
it's not an
yeah.
or. I don't think, you know, you wouldn't want, I mean, if we had, you know, five white males under two, I mean, they would be confused with the word or.
Mm.
That's, I mean, they make that firm may qualify for other reasons, but that what we're saying is that it's one not to be disqualified by two,
okay.
not or, is the way I think about it.
Yeah, and
is that
was the same reaction that I had when I...
Yeah, you're right.
Because Gilbert, to Gilbert's point, just to echo his concern about diversity and inclusion, is that you won't find a lot of, like, you know, minority-owned or women-owned that are going to be, like, even a billion, you know what I mean?
Well, so they would not, like right now, if we just had one, they would not be disqualified if they were under $2 billion. We, for each search, we kind of set out what size we're looking for depending on that asset class.
Okay.
So I would say that the best course is just to leave it at one and knowing that we might need to include, you know, look at some smaller firms in a search to make sure that we're canvassing the universe properly. So I think the way we're talking about this, two is confusing. You keep it at just economic ownership, 50% diverse, and then we should be able to meet that going forward and leave the size component out of it completely.
But in the criteria, isn't this like a performance? I mean, like, they don't even make mustard if they're not performing with similar.
Clearly. Well, they'll get an,
yeah.
RF,
yeah.
They'll get an RFP, and
okay.
then they'll make that evaluation and make an
assessment. And this was like, it says in the, if there, we do a search in a kind of a smaller area and there's just no diverse firms that meet the criteria, then we don't need to include one. So
let me chime in here, and I'm going to let Chuck talk about what his experience at the state level. The Ryan made the point, which I think is the right point, from a, as fiduciaries, it's, this kind of policy is good, is fine, but the overriding concern has to be the return aspect. General fiduciary law would say that. I think the IRS would say that, and the Texas AG would say that as well, is that as long as you are benefiting from an investment perspective, then this is fine. So I think it's So the point that Ryan just made is that, yes, if there's nobody that really is got that type of exposure, then they're not going to be included in the RFP. And Chuck, do you want to kind of talk about what you see at the state level?
Can I just jump in here? The whole basis of searching for an emerging manager is that there have been studies that show that smaller, emerging, new, hungrier managers outperform large managers. So the idea here, I think nationally, about including an emerging manager, you know, policy or program or what have you, is to ultimately leverage that. And so by no means do I think anyone in the board is suggesting that we dumb it down and look for an emerging manager or a diverse manager and compromise returns. The idea is to look for that emerging manager that is really outperforming, you know, the BlackRock, really, and they're out there.
Yeah.
So otherwise, other plans wouldn't be doing this. So I just want to jump in because that's never, that's not at all the purpose of.
Yeah, I think the last sentence in the purpose is the key. It says, seek to find smaller and diverse managers that can benefit the system by enhancing risk-adjusted returns and net of fees. I mean, that has got to be the goal.
Right, yeah.
And so, I mean, to include them in the RFP, we have to evaluate that and come to that conclusion.
Well, and I confess that this is language that we took, which is, I think, the best, most concise description of what a policy should look like. It's comes right from the ERS language in their statute, and I think it's a good description. But, Chuck, do you want to kind of talk about what you see at the state level?
Sure. First of all, kind of your overall fiduciary duties, right? What's the sole best interest of members and beneficiaries? So anytime you have a policy that is looking at a broader, topics, you do want to have a policy that ties that program to what's in the best interest of the system, which is, from an economic perspective, risk-adjusted return. And that's why it is important to have this in the policy. It is very, all statewide and others, it comes to the point that Tina made and Nancy made as well with respect to, having diverse emerging managers is to the economic benefit of the system, and it's just important to have that in policy. And so with the second point and the one or two, I think either's fine. I do think ultimately, yes, you as fiduciary still have to make a call in terms of what's the best return, risk-adjusted return of the system and what's best for the system. I think, and it sounds like when I read the language and was looking at it, when I saw the one or two, it was not kind of a disqualification. Was, if in a particular asset class, there was not an ownership, you didn't meet the number one, you could at least meet number two. But it sounds like that's really not the case.
That's what was intended, but I don't think that's what maybe the board desires.
That's right. And so
you can always do that without having it in the policy.
Yeah.
I mean, if you're doing a search for a small fund manager and we're going to give them $50 million, if you find the best firm is out there has $1 billion, you're going to still include them.
That's right. So
you just don't need it.
Well, Chuck, I would say if we want to keep it focused on diverse managers, we can tweak the language in here to call it and drop emerging and say diverse managers and only have kind of point one. And to me, that's the clearest way to move forward.
Okay. Is there a consensus around that?
I agree.
I think we should actually see, if it's okay, maybe we don't vote. I think we should vote on something that is, words on a paper.
Okay.
So we'll just have that for next month. But I want to make sure, is that the will of all of you?
So what we'll do next month is
that work, Josh, for you, Kelly?
Mm-hmm.
Did you have it?
We'll show the updated language, where it would go in the actual IPS, and show a red line of the investment policy for approval.
Is the 50% also in line with the RS's policy?
Yes. That is in line with ERS has in policy. The economic ownership term is something that teachers have in their program, which I think is also an important factor, that it's not just kind of shadow ownership to meet some qualifications.
Shadow ownership,
It's an evolving issue, I think, because a lot of the bigger firms, people are looking at the minority employees within the firm and are considering some of those things as well, but that's going to evolve.
Yeah. All right.
When you look for a new manager, what's the data source that you go to or the software system that you use?
We use, on the public side, we use eVestment, and we can pull down kind of all sorts of information, and they have an ownership, you know, kind of this exact field in there that we could look at. Sometimes it's not always clear between firms, but we also ask about it during the RFP process. So,
and we get information from Makita.
And we kind of combine that with Makita's list and who they know and have talked to.
These type of policies also ensure some of this ESG kind of approach to things, wouldn't you say, as far as the social or governance?
Yeah, I mean, I would say it's something that we, you know, already look at, already ask about as far as, you know, the list of all the kind of qualitative organizational, you know, scoring of a firm during an RFP. So I like having it in policy because it is something that we have asked about and rated firms on in the last four searches. So
I would just say on the whole ESG side, my view is that definitions evolve.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Whereas, you know, minority ownership is an objective, you know, standard, you know, that we all know it wouldn't be. But if we said, what is ESG just amongst us, you know, I might have a different view than some of you, and I may have a different view from what I thought 3 months ago.
There's no standardized.
Yeah.
And the key is, I mean, ESG is a risk. I mean, any risk that a firm has should be evaluated in making an investment, whether it's leverage or management or whatever it is. So it's one of the risk factors without getting that specific as to how you do it.
All right, one more month of this, and we'll get it in policy and get it approved. All right, so on the consultant search, we also talked to the IAC about this. We covered it at a high level when we talked about private market considerations with the board in November, but we're coming up at the five-year mark with Makita. As a reminder, we're not contracted with them at all on the private market side. They do reporting, but they don't, given that we weren't planning on making any new investments and haven't made any new investments in private markets, we don't have, you know, we're not contracted for them to provide services on that front. So we're planning to do a consultant RFP early in 2023, knowing that, you know, some point here in the future, maybe relatively shortly, we're going to be making new private markets investments. So, you know, we need to figure out what that looks like, what the right level of service is, how we're using the consultant for private markets. So what we want to do, what we talked to the IAC about, was appointing a subcommittee of the board and IAC to advise staff in regards to the search and what that looks like. So we had a discussion, and the people that have raised their hands willing to serve on the subcommittee are Nancy and Ken from the board, and then Rakesh, Tom Toll, and Ryan Bailey from the IAC. So I think it's a good group. If you, you know,
hey,
CIOs on
there. They are asking, I'm going to push back on wanting the executed.
Sorry.
No,
I think that's a separate conversation. Okay. So we have a group of five board and IAC members willing to serve on the subcommittee. I have a timeline what it looks like going forward. The next step from here, if the board appoints a subcommittee, is to have a kickoff meeting with the subcommittee to review what the RFP looks like, what, you know, how many firms we're planning to go invite to submit for the RFP. Right now, I think it looks like, you know, maybe a few, two, three on the general consulting side, and then talking to potentially a few specialty private markets consulting firms. And we've designed the RFP where people can bid on, you know, all of it, a piece of it, only private market. So, and then going forward, I think we could issue the RFP potentially at the beginning of February and then kind of evaluate, select, you know, firms, meet with the subcommittee over kind of Q1 into Q2. So.
Can I ask, I'm not very experienced in this, how do you take into account your cumulative view on how Makita has done? I mean, I'm assuming that they submit, you know, themselves as a go-forward applicant. how as a practical matter do you sort of weigh in that, yeah, I like the job they're doing and we like the reporting and, you know, it's working well, knowing there could be better options, but having an overall sense where expectations have been met consistently.
Mm-hmm.
How do you, as a practical point, factor that in to something like this?
Well, I'll give an example of a search that we did for our broker for our health insurance reason.
Mm-hmm.
So we have used the same health insurance broker for 20 or more years and liked them, but felt we needed to go out and do a search. And I was really thinking when we did that, we'd probably end up with the same broker again. But what we found was the proposal that we got back promised all kinds of things that they're not doing now. And then the new firms came in and promised all kinds of things that the old group didn't mention or did mention but weren't offering us currently. So I think we, you know, just kind of really informally, the group that had been working with them said, yeah, they're saying this now, but they never offered this before. And they're saying they're going to call us back in 24 hours, but they're not doing that. So I think it's really, you know, you look at the proposal and say, does this make sense with the actual behavior? So it's more, you know, it's not really a checklist. It's like, does this make sense?
Yeah.
That's what we've really been in.
I would say it's a little bit more complicated than that because they've made recommendations that we may have overridden and they were right and we were maybe not, you know what I mean? They've also just suggested something like, you know, the cushion. You know, and that was something that they did that was standard with another, I think, system. They've also, you know, advised on the discount rate or timing. It's really kind of hard to go back and see what they suggested, maybe, and what was done
mm-hmm.
with their consult. I'm just saying, how do you judge that?
Yeah.
Go ahead, Josh.
Well, I was going to say, as a board, I mean, you all need to sort of give your view because, I mean, the consultant, while they work more day-to-day with staff, you know, they report to you guys on a, you know, they come in here on a regular basis, they provide reports, they give you advice, they give you, you know, so it, the staff's got a view of how they think Makita does and how their skills and how they're working with them and their effectiveness, and but you all need to sort of, it, you know, it's as important, if not more important, as fiduciaries for you guys to sort of give your views. Whether it's, you know, whether you want to call Kelly or Ryan and say, hey, you know, I think this is great or I think this is not great, or when we make the final decision. But, I mean, it's that dual level of work with staff, work with board, how that kind of comes together that, I mean, so, you know.
Doing a search is always a good thing to do from a sharpening the pencil.
Right.
I mean, their cost may be out of line or they may sharpen their pencil and come back even lower than where they are now. Just because they know they're competing, whereas if you just renewed it, you wouldn't get that. And one of the hard parts in this search is going to be looking at the private equity.
Yes.
Do you have one firm or do you use two firms?
Yes.
And given our staff resources, I think that's going to be a real issue. We're going to have to.
I was on the investment committee search as well, and I thought, if I recall, I thought staff did a great job about, like, juxtaposing the ones we had seen,
mm-hmm.
the one that we had at the time, Makita, and I think two or three others, and bringing them up and, you know, comparing, contrasting. But to your point, this was, we're looking at private equity. We're looking at that space, which is a little bit different. So, and I remember that this was also, the application of diversity was also applied to the investment advisor as well, and their profile, their inner profile, their makeup.
Right.
So,
I mean, one of the other challenges is the size of the private equity allocation that will actually be available to
us
and the ability to attract a separate manager for such a small allocation.
Yeah. And I mean, I think part of doing this process is we're assessing, you know, what type of private equity investing do you think we're going to be doing, how many number of investments, what size, how are you using the consultant to go through that search process, you know, to kind of, we need to hone in on what we expect it to look like and how that drives who we should be using to provide advice on what we're doing in the private market.
And to your point, it's not like we're like you know, blocking and tackling. We're actually, this is proactive, right, for searches for private equity managers, right?
Yeah. And
a lot of our, yeah, to that point, right, and what kind of capital do we have for those new searches?
And really what we're talking about on that side is, you know, we have, right now we have 5% allocation to private equity, which is 90 to 100 million, 5% to real estate, which is 90 to 100 million, and then the natural resources with Hancock, that's, you know, currently already allocated, and we plan to keep that as part of that long term. So it's not a huge part of the portfolio that we're talking about. So, you know, figuring out if you do need one or two firms for that and how that could work.
Yeah, I mean, Nikita made a good point, and other firms will do the same thing, but, I mean, if we're only going to do $5, $7, $10 million allocations, it's going to be hard to access good firms. But they can get an allocation for all their clients of $100 million, and we can fold in. So that's going to be a consideration.
Yeah,
they or other people who can provide us access to better managers than we can do on our own.
Yeah, that's a good point.
And I think the, you know, benefit of using the subcommittee is we have, you know, the investment expertise of the IAC members, you know, helping us with the search, and we can, you know, kind of be, you know, as open and frank as possible when we're talking about, you know, what we're looking at, what we need in that setting.
So what I would suggest is that Nancy and Kenneth, too, on the committee, part of your responsibility would be to collect and filter feedback from all of us and staff on how Nikita has done relative to the proposals and all the good things we'll get from the RFP process. So,
all right, so motion would be to form a subcommittee and appoint the members that we talked about to that subcommittee.
Let me just put a finer point on that, Nick. I think if you would filter the feedback through the staff, and then they'll kind of disseminate it so that we don't create a
open meeting back
thing. So, you know.
Oh.
Sorry.
I budgeted my hand getting slapped twice.
Josh?
And I had one right off the strip. Number two.
Basically, send feedback to
Josh. Josh, given we've got a lot of new members, can you just review that Open Meeting Act requirement so that other people are sensitive to it?
What you meant is give feedback to Ryan. Is that what you meant? Because that's what I heard.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we obviously. You see it a lot of times when we send emails, we blind copy y'all because we don't want a bunch of emails going around. We, you know, I send something or Kelly sends something and, you know, we blind copy you and then you respond, you know, and similarly with phone calls, we don't want a bunch of conversations going on amongst trustees that could constitute a walking, what they call it, walking quorum. So we try to, you know, just like with the committee, we limit the number of people on it and then we further limit the communication so that it's through staff to the people, and we.
And Josh, this is a reminder: what constitutes a walk-in quorum?
So a walk-in quorum would, I mean.
How many people is that?
So a quorum is six, because there's 11 trustees. So if, I mean, the smoking gun would be an email between six trustees where there was kind of communication. So then that would be just a lay down sort of violation. Then, you know, you have these conversations that go on where A talks to B, B talks to C, saying what A said and so on, and that's more of a, you know, or what you see, which I think, unfortunately, I think you see in not just in the state of Texas but everywhere, more in the city council perspective where the council's all in together and they all kind of walk down the hall and talk to each other and that, you know, it's almost unavoidable. But, I mean, we try to do our best to make sure that y'all are staying on the right side of the Open Meetings Act. So,
I guess, you know, just to clarify, so it doesn't, you know, if Nancy got five people in a room, that's pretty obvious. But the walking part is if Nancy calls Steve and then Nancy calls Ken and then Nancy calls Tony and then Nancy calls Mike, you know. So it doesn't have to be everybody in the room, everybody on the same email chain, but it's just that walking part of the, you know, getting everybody kind of in that conversation.
I was happy doing it in context of a meeting, making it, you know, feedback. I mean,
that's great.
Yeah. So,
And when Josh said the blind copy of the email, that reminded me, I sent you guys a blackout list on Friday, which is a change in process, and I'll try to mention it during the portfolio update if anyone's on it. Previously, we had put that on Diligent, and we didn't feel like it was getting in front of the trustees. you know, as much as maybe it should. So we'll email you who's on that list, which is going to be consultants for a while, and maybe, you know, equity managers, you know, if we get into a search there. So we'll update that monthly and send it out via email to you guys.
So is everyone comfortable with the formation of the committee and the timelines that Ryan talked about? Could you go ahead and put the motion?
Yeah.
Everyone okay doing that now? Okay. So the recommended motion would be to form a subcommittee to advise the staff in regards to the planned consultant search process and appoint board members Nancy Rocha and Ken Haven and IAC members Rakesh to take the heat. Tom Toll and Ryan Bailey to the subcommittee. We have a motion.
I'll move that as chair.
Second?
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries.
Thank you.
Okay, so we're going to go into closed session now, Josh.
Do you want me to do the briefing items first?
Yes, I'm going to go ahead and do that.
All right, on page 60 is your NCPERS newsletters. As far as open records requests go, we've received one that was completed since the last board meeting, received another one this morning. Staffing updates, Ann Matthews, who's a retirement counselor, has been with the system for 15 years. She's retiring January 24th. She's very well known by the members. She's been the person that's been really for the past 15 years dealing with the deaths of members and setting up survivors. So a lot of the members know Ann. We were really lucky, and we've already found her replacement, a lady named Jasmine Trotman. Jasmine started on December 28th. This is her first retirement gig, but she's very smart, has two master's degrees. I think she'll do great. We're no longer going to have, like, one person dedicated to just the deaths. We're now going to split all the tasks between all the retirement counselors. So if you ever get a member that calls you and wants to talk to somebody and they're saying, who should I call, the best bet is to have them call the front desk, and then we will route them. We're going to split it by alphabet. So A through L currently is Amy, and then, you know. So just always try to refer them to the front desk instead of the specific person. That would be helpful. But we're excited about Jasmine. We're happy for Ann. So moving forward.
What's name, Fluffy?
Matthews.
How was it trying to find somebody? I mean, you hear all these labor issues now.
Well, we did hire a search firm.
You did?
We did, because it's a very critical position. She was the first person we interviewed, and awesome.
So no real issue in hiring?
No. I mean, we actually scheduled somebody before Jasmine for the interview, and that person found a job within a day, and our interview was the next day. So we lost that person, but this lady's
That's
very
great.
Impressive. So I think we got lucky.
Good job.
So that's good. So she's been training since the 28th and has done a great job.
Okay, so we're going to go into closed session now.